are even insured people getting big bills for emergency department visits?
Is there an upper limit of benefit to vigorous exercise?
Can organic food consumption reduce your risk of cancer?
And does giving more calories to critically ill individuals improve their outcome?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on October 26th, 2018.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, as we've been doing, I think I'd like to toss the ball directly to you. Let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, this idea that, gosh, if people are critically ill, they're in the ICU, and we provide them with more calories, can we improve survival?
We're talking about people who are admitted to the intensive care unit and frequently can't eat on their own. What we try to do is make sure they have a certain amount of calories. Well, you know, we're oftentimes not very good. We predict what they need and we fall short about a third of the time of providing the necessary calories. So if we give energy-dense feedings, could we improve their outcome? They looked at almost 4,000 patients. So they divided them into those that got on average about 1,900 kilocalories per day and those that got about 1,200. And they started the feeding almost immediately, that is within the first 24 hours, and continued it for up to 28 days. They used mortality as the outcome. And what they found was that there was no benefit at all in providing the energy-dense feeding. They looked at age, less than or greater than 65, and they realized age didn't make a difference. And they also looked at people that were considered to be undernourished to begin with. They had a BMI less than 18.5, and even those individuals didn't benefit from energy-dense calories.
Of course, we're trying to get our arms around what interventions do make a difference in people who are critically ill. And we've talked about, well, if you need to bring somebody's fluid back up, using some products is better than others with regard to outcomes. We look a lot at things like blood sugar. What's that doing? What about respirations? What about heart rates? So I think this is a good news study in that it shows that, gosh, we're trying, but it didn't really work out.
No, anything we can do to improve their outcome is desirable. And importantly, avoiding things that don't help.
I'd like to turn now to one that really bothers me. This was in JAMA Open. It's taking a look at a specific health insurer, Anthem, and taking a look at their ED department coverage, emergency department coverage, for adults who are insured who presented to the emergency department. In this case, this is a cross-sectional analysis. It's a subsample of ED visits from January 1, 2011 to December 31, 2015. About almost 16%, 15.7% of these folks who were insured by Anthem would have ended up having their emergency department coverage denied based on what exactly the findings were. And they also identified that these denial diagnosis visits shared the same presenting symptoms as the majority, almost 88%, of commercially insured adult ED visits, with all the other characteristics being the same. And I'm really troubled by this because we know that financial toxicity is a huge problem for patients. And I'm troubled by the idea that somehow a patient needs to decide or a person needs to decide, gosh, do I have something that's emergent or not? I'm worried about whether I'm going to end up with a huge bill when I come out of the ED.
Insurance companies would like to decrease emergency room visits that aren't truly emergencies. Unfortunately, from the patient's perspective, oftentimes you don't know whether it's an emergency condition or not. Many of the patients that presented to the emergency department had chest pain or abdominal pain or headache. And from their perspective, they don't know whether it's an emergency or not, and they present to the emergency department, and the physician may say, well, gosh, that's not really an emergency. So to have that denied, that coverage denied, puts the onus on the patient to make the diagnosis. And by the way, the physician and nurses arrive at this diagnosis after examining the patient. The patient can't examine themselves. Sometimes after doing tests, and the patient can't do the test on themselves. So I agree with you. This denial of coverage, especially because the symptoms don't distinguish between what is a non-emergent, what's an emergent visit, is a real problem.
And I'm glad it's being brought into awareness because I find that sometimes these things just slip in under the cracks and all of a sudden people end up without coverage or some other kind of thing related to the cost of medical care that is really unpleasant and adds to the burden.
And so I'm appreciative that our Harvard colleagues put this out because it brings it to the awareness of the public and to healthcare providers as well, and hopefully to insurance companies.
Excellent. Let's turn to another one in JAMA Open. That's taking a look at cardiorespiratory fitness as measured on a treadmill and what that says about mortality risk.
In general, if you ask individuals, is exercise beneficial? Everybody's going to say yes. We know that people exercise have a lower incidence of coronary artery disease, less likely to have hypertension, diabetes, stroke, cancer. But the question posed is, does habitual vigorous exercise provide those same benefits? Because there has been some concern that really elite athletes don't receive the benefit. And that is, it's kind of a U-shaped curve where things get better. And then if you have habitual vigorous exercise, you actually lose some of that benefit. And so to address that, these investigators looked at over 122,000 patients that had exercise treadmill testing. And that really does distinguish between people that are elite athletes, that's about 2.5% of the population. People that are high-performing athletes, about 25%. Those that are above average and those that are below average. And they followed these individuals over a number of years, a total of 1.1 million person years of observation to determine if there was a benefit across all those levels of exercise. And what they determined was cardiorespiratory fitness is inversely related to mortality. The more you exercise, the better your survival. But more importantly, there was no upper limit of benefit. In fact, when you compared the elite athletes to those that were just high performing, there was about a 23% reduction in mortality over this time period in the elite athletes. And by the way, there's benefit every time you improve your exercise or get better, you improve your survival as well.
This is so fascinating, isn't it? Because gosh, this is yet one more of these things we are trying to get our arms around. How much exercise needs to be recommended in order for people to achieve mortality benefits? And that 30 minutes per day, most days of the week, it's sounding pretty inadequate based on this.
The message is get involved with exercise, do as much as you can, and rest assured that if you're one of those individuals that really wants to exercise vigorously, you do still receive a benefit from it. So exercise, regardless of what level you can be involved with.
I'm also wondering about other strategies like these brief intervention, really interval, intense exercisers who say that they achieve better cardiorespiratory fitness.
So we're balancing one thing, cardiorespiratory fitness versus orthopedic injuries. You have to work your way up to it. The more cardiovascular fit you are, the better your overall outcome, the better your survival. That's the key message.
And since we're talking about survival then, let's go to JAMA Internal Medicine. This huge French study took a look retrospectively at the consumption of organic foods and the development of cancer. It's a population-based study. They recruited French adult volunteers, and they asked them, of course, to keep their organic food consumption history and dietary intake for 16 products. Participants reported their consumption frequency of labeled organic foods, and they got then, as a result of that, an organic food score was computed. They had almost 70,000 participants. They followed them from May 10th, 2009 to November 30th, 2016. During that time, and of course, here we go with that number crunch, they had 1,340 first incident cancer cases that were identified. And the upshot of the whole thing was the more organic food you consumed, the lower your risk of developing cancer.
There were two cancers they correlated organic food intake with, postmenopausal breast cancer and non-Hodgkin lymphoma. All right, let's take a step back and look at the study. First of all, it's retrospective. Secondly, it's a survey. You ask people to recall of 16 different types of foods. Did they eat organically? Was that frequently or infrequently? Not surprisingly, the people that were organic food eaters were more likely to have healthy lifestyles, things associated with a better outcome. I'm concerned that organic foods are oftentimes expensive and inaccessible to much of the population. So I don't want anybody listening to this to be discouraged saying, gosh, I can't afford, I don't have access to organic food, and therefore I'm not going to have a diet that's high in vegetables, fruits, and nuts. That's not the message at all.
I agree with that. Certainly we quip all the time. Right around the office, we have a Whole Foods and we quip and call it Whole Paycheck because it just seems so expensive to go there and purchase those things that are organic. So the jury's out. I'll agree with that. And I think what we really need is a study that really examines this critically in a prospective fashion and is able to chronicle what people eat. That's a tough study to do.
It is. And Elizabeth, I can say there have been other studies that looked at this that didn't show a benefit. So I don't think that this particular study, this retrospective survey study, really gives a definitive answer, in my opinion.
To find the hyperlinks for the studies, please check out our program notes on the website. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.